I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We go along the famed Alaska Highway and see the way of life and experiences of travelers and lodge owners alike in a new book, Beyond Mile Zero, The Vanishing Alaska Highway Lodge Community. It's a history, travelogue, and document of the past and present of the kinds of people that populate this stretch of road, providing accommodations and meals since the highway opened in 1948. It's a way of life that is disappearing as well. The writing of Lily Gontard and Mark Kelly's photographs evoke the past and present, the scenic beauty. It almost makes one want to go there. The Food Illustrated looks tasty, too. Lily Gontard and Mark Kelly join me now. She is a writer living in Whitehorse. Her fiction, poetry, and nonfiction have appeared in magazines such as Pushing Out the Boat, Geist, The Puritan Magazine, and Cirque. Mark Kelly moved to the Yukon in 1999, where he runs a counseling practice. As a photographer, he has traveled the world. I'll ask Lily and Mark about their own travels along the Alaskan Highway before and during the writing of this book, which is published by Lost Moose. The Twitter handle for more is at Beyond Mile Zero. Please welcome to the Planta Online program in Whitehorse, Lily Gontard. Ms. Gontard, good morning.
Good morning.
And also in Whitehorse, Mark Kelly. Mr. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm good, thank you.
So this is, as I was telling you just before we started, such a good book because it tells us about some just utterly fascinating people, just an amazing landscape and a place to live. For you, Lily, were you born up north, or how did you end up in Whitehorse?
No, I'm originally from Quebec.
Oh, I see.
But I moved up, I moved up north probably, well, it's about 25 years ago, I guess, 25 years ago now. And I went up to go and live, kind of a subsistence lifestyle, build a cabin, do that kind of thing. What 20-year-olds do.
Right, right. And what was your deal, Mark? Where did you grow up?
There's two stories that bring people to the Yukon. One is the story Lily just told, and the other is came for a canoe trip and never left. And that's my story. I mean, I came up, I got to paddle up here in '95, and then I came back up here to help a friend move to a place called Pelly Crossing, which is about 3 hours towards Dawson City from here. And I never left after that.
It's I was just telling you before we started, I haven't traveled this country very much, and this is a place where you all live and where you've traveled to in the course of writing this book. Is not a place I've ever been, but I really felt in reading the book almost nostalgic for the things that you chronicle that have since gone, but also I guess it's a lifestyle, isn't it?
Living in the park is a choice in the lifestyle.
Yeah.
I mean, some people come up because they're transferred with their government jobs, and so they don't really have a choice. But and people are born here, of course. But I think if you make the decision to move from another part of the country, there is a big reason behind that, and it's either the adventure. Most people, I think, they want to be closer to nature. I think. Same with Marcus, with myself, and that's one thing that we have here is a lot of space.
And so, do you miss the city at all, Mark?
Not even a little bit.
Yeah.
I go down, I get a sort of an injection. I mean, I was born in Toronto, and I was raised in Calgary. I moved every 9 years until I landed here at 28. I was born in Toronto. I moved to Calgary when I was 9. I moved to the coast to Victoria when I was 18, and then. Then I moved up here when I was 28, and I go down south once in a while, just to because you got to get to other places. But
yeah.
About 3 days in, I'm done and ready to go home.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I love going to the city. And yesterday I was talking with some friends, and we were talking about how much we love to take the SkyTrain, and we love to be on public transit in Toronto.
you'll get a different response from people in either Vancouver or Toronto regarding public transportation, I'll bet.
When you live there, I think it's much less nostalgic
Lily, when you set off to write the book, because you do start the book in terms of giving us the history of this highway, the Alaska Highway, when was it built and at its height? How many lodges were along this stretch of road?
Well, it was built in 1942, and then it wasn't open to the public until 1948. And at that time, there was a lodge roughly every 20 miles. We talk in miles now, both Mark and I. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it's the tradition of the highway to speak in miles. I've lost my kilometers.
And so it also, the book speaks to how, you know, everything's evolved, not only up there, but even just how we travel. And so the state of how many lodges there are today, I mean, you said one every 20 miles then. Now it's what?
Oh.
Well, Seth, sometimes it's like you're lucky some places, some sections of the road, especially north of Haines Junction, it's like every, 200 kilometers or 300.
Mark, you took the photographs in the book. What do you want to represent when you're taking a picture, say? Because I'm wondering, because when I look at the photographs in the book, I obviously think that I'm there, or I can see what was there, depending on the photo. Is what you see what's in the image that we see, say, in a book? Like this?
Well, practically, not any longer. Many of the photographs, I started taking them in 2011, and a lot of the places have since gone. So if you were to go looking for those scenes that are in the book, especially of the abandoned places, mm-hmm. many of them wouldn't exist anymore. But what really drew me to taking, I have a thing for abandoned places. I always have. Right from the time I got my first camera as a kid, I photographed empty and abandoned places. And I think largely what it was trying to get a sense of what happened there. What were the stories of that place? Who was there? Who were the people? What was their lives like? And so I get drawn into these. Really, they're quite decrepit places often. And I can be in there for hours. Lily will attest to that. She sometimes had to set off a flare to get me to come back out. I'd be in there just riveted by the things that are pinned to walls or the furniture or the things that people have left behind. And so largely, it's the short answer, I suppose, would be just the stories of what was that drew me in. And, of course, for the photographs of modern time, of the time that people are around, it's the stories of why they're there and who they are and what drew them to those places that got me to photograph the people.
Yeah, Mark. Do you use any like in terms of the equipment that you use? I mean, you obviously use like a professional camera, or are you like most of us using whatever phone device we have?
No, I shoot with two different setups. One, I shoot with Canon professional gear.
Yeah.
And I shoot with Fuji professional gear.
Yeah. And do you use your phone though to take pictures? Say if you're at lunch with you know, as we all do now, I guess.
I can only think of one photograph that's actually not in the book that I use my phone for, and it's a road sign on the side of the highway, which we used for our Facebook page for quite a while. But no, I have an SLR or a mirrorless camera with me all the time. I do use my phone. That's not to say that the phone doesn't do good photographs. It's just I'm kind of a traditionalist that way. I use an SLR as much as I can.
Yeah. Lily, when you go to some of these places, especially the abandoned places that Mark just alluded to, what does it feel like? I mean, and you know, I'm looking at pictures in the book here of, you know, places that are no longer there, places that are boarded up, or places that have been razed, you know, the abandoned phone booths and the sort. I mean, you do a wonderful job in the book, in the writing, to sort of evoke what it was once like, and do you feel that when you go back and it's abandoned, say?
I think some places feel like museums without any interpretation, though, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Some places, I didn't find any place that felt haunted or spooky. When you talk about Mark going into these abandoned lodges, some of them I couldn't stand the amount of mouse poop that was everywhere, you know, like, so they're often really filthy. When it was after I did interviews with people, after we'd visited some of the abandoned lodges, that then I could really see what had existed, because as Mark said, well, you know, some of these lodges have already been burned down or torn down, so there's nothing left, or parts have disappeared. And so when you talk to someone and they tell you the stories about what occurred in the lodge, and then you start to imagine the scene in the abandoned places.
Yeah. And when you talk to people, say, who had a lodge, and are no longer in the business, and then you go back to where their business was, are you able to piece together what they've told you and what you see? And, I mean, do you get a real sense of what it might have been like?
Yes. I think of one place in particular. Well, I didn't get to interview the owners of Lower Liard River Lodge, but I did do some research on it, and there's a... It's a lodge that has been abandoned for a few years and was burnt down in a bush party a couple of years ago, I think it was. But the research that I did, I found out, you know, the couple that ran it, their CB radio handle was the Laughing Leprechaun, which just tells me so much about them.
Yeah.
And they had a helipad. They had... like an RV park, they had the restaurant, the hotel, a store, gas station, mechanic. They had so much going on, and now it's literally charred remains.
Yeah. Mark, how would you guys work? I guess my understanding is you had a bunch of photos initially, and then you go to Lily and you're wondering what to do with them. Is that right?
Yeah, when I first started photographing them, my wife had said about halfway through our first journey that I should do something with these photos, maybe a photo essay, and I thought that was a great idea. And you know, I have a master's degree, so I can write, but I write like somebody who's been to university. I don't write creatively, so I knew that I was unlikely I'd ever actually write an article. So I've known Lily for a very long time, so I called her and said, would you help me out? And she, right away, said, absolutely. But that's how they got started.
And so when you decide to write a book like this, do you get a sense that, a sense of urgency, if you will, that this needs to be done now because so many of these places are gone and a lot of these folks, you know, won't be around, you know, later on, that you're capturing a bit of time here, not just the present?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Last summer, in I guess it was August, I was doing my final drive up to Fairbanks to get some final photographs before we went to press. And there's a place called Mile 1118. It's the Kewaunee Wilderness Village. On one side of the highway and the other side of the highway was Scully's Saloon and Cafe. And, you know, I had photographed it years before. So I just drove by it, and 3 days later I came back and it was gone.
Huh.
It was razed to the ground, and it was sort of a really good reminder that these things are not going to be around for much longer. Last year, another place, Swift River, you mentioned the abandoned phone booth, that's from Swift River, and it was bulldozed last year as well, and so I'm glad I captured these places before they went, but. To answer your question, there is always a sense of urgency. If you'll indulge me for a second, I was chatting with an elder here on Monday, and he was telling me about a place called Cracker Creek, which was also known as Cricket Crack, and he said he gave me the directions to find. There's five buildings abandoned. They're still there that I had no idea existed. And I feel a real urgency to get out there and photograph those before they are torn down or burnt down. And he says they're still standing, so it's on my list in the next few weeks to get out there and find them.
Lily, how much of the highway did you guys travel in the course of writing this book together for the research, the photographs, and the sort? I mean, were there a lot of road trips involved?
Yeah, we did one, two, four road trips together. So we drove about the highway about four times the distance of the highway. That's crazy.
Yeah, and so how long would that take it, and what would the day involve? I mean, would you stop for meals and the sort?
The days were long, and because there was a lot of stopping along the way to be photographed. And the one thing that, you know, when we were driving along the highway, what we would come across are the remains of the roadhouses. But it was the hunt for the people who had run the roadhouses which really took us away from just that, you know, like, we had to talk to people, look in the old mileposts, find, you know, search on telephone directories, and ask in local communities. It was a real, almost, I'm going to just say the easy part, was driving on that highway, and then there would be a building, and then we could, you know, or an operating lodge. But actually finding the stories of the people who aren't living there anymore, or the buildings don't exist anymore, that was quite challenging.
Yeah. When you talk to these people, Lily, and you talk to the people that live and work there now, what are some of the reasons why they end up there? And are they the same reasons that brought people there, say, 50, 60 years ago?
I actually think it's absolutely the same reasons. You know, and when the highway first opened, people went there because, you know, they wanted to escape the rat race of the lower 48 in the United States, or how busy things were in Alberta. And now the people who go to run lodges, they like being out in the middle of nowhere, having their space, their freedom, being their own bosses, and really living on their own schedule.
Yeah. Mark, when Lily would be interviewing people, would you be part of those conversations as well?
Sometimes. It depends on our time. But, you know, no matter how many times I've driven the highway, and I really couldn't even tell you how many that is now, I forget how truly long it is. So we would land somewhere, and we'd get into these great conversations, and then I would realize I've got to get out and photograph. And so I would leave after we started talking for a bit. And that was a bit of a downside, because I missed a number of the stories live. I mean, I got them from Lily afterwards, but I think... If we were to wind back the clock, I'd want to have that opportunity as well, and to have listened to everybody's story. I mean, practically, it's very difficult to do that. It's just triple the time. But I did listen to some stories, and I wish I'd heard more. I often would go off and shoot, and then come back in and ask some questions about some of the things that I saw, and folks would fill me in on that, and then that would go into the notes.
And so, Lily, how would you structure these conversations with people in terms of, I mean, did you find that they were easy to talk to, that they were willing to bear themselves, if you will?
Absolutely. Everyone was so willing to participate in the project. And I thought at the time it's because no one had ever asked them before. Mm. But we recently found out, as we did our book tour on the southern end of the highway, that we would show up at the different lodges, and people would be so happy to see us, and they were so excited by the book, because prior to us going and interviewing people, many, many people have traveled up the highway and interviewed lodge owners and done nothing with what they got from those interviews. And so, you know, one thing that we are doing with our interview transcripts and the audio and the photographs is, when we're done this project, we are going to be donating them to the Yukon Archive so that they'll be accessible to the public.
Yeah, yeah. It's a marvelous service that you both have done in terms of what you've done in the book. The other thing that really captured me, and I guess one of the reasons why it's made me want to go up there, is the food. And I'm wondering, in terms of meals and the food along the way, along the highway at these various lodges, They're must taste good. And in terms of cost, I mean, what's that like?
Well, the further you are from a major center, the more expensive it is. So you would think as you headed north, it would just get incrementally more expensive, but
yeah.
It doesn't. Like, you know, it's expensive when you're in the middle of, let's say if you're in Muncho Lake, it's fairly pricey in comparison to when you get closer to Whitehorse, it's not. And then when you get north of Whitehorse, the prices go up until you get to Tok, and then they go down again. And then, so, I mean, it's definitely not traveling in the lower 48 or in the southern part of Canada. It's definitely more expensive than that. But it's not a crippling expense. Often, for fuel, for example, is less expensive here than it is on Vancouver Island.
Mm.
So it just depends on where you are in the stages of the highway.
Yeah. But there must have been some memorable meals. Were there, Lily, for you?
Let me see. Well, I have to say Jack Gunness's breakfast at the Double G Service is the most memorable. I love his bread. His bread is about a foot high, his loaves of bread. It's the most amazing bread. And you know, you can't finish the breakfast he serves you. And if you can, you're a superhero.
A lot of cinnamon buns. I'm allergic to cinnamon, but it's made me want to, you know, indulge, if you will.
That's what I was going to say. You can't drive the highway without a cinnamon bun. And we would be controversial if we were to say which lodge has the best cinnamon buns, because there are many who sell them. I will say that there is not a bad one on the highway. But I will say, if you're going to stop at anywhere for a drink, I would stop at Coal River and ask for a chocolate shake. It was probably the best shake I've ever had in my life.
Huh. A lot of these places are for sale today.
I think a lot of them are perpetually for sale.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to sell a lodge, and so folks will buy them and run them for a few years and then put them up for sale, not because they are failing business or they want out, but because it can take a long time for a lodge to move. So best to get it on the market just in time for you to retire.
Yeah. Lily, you talked to some people in the book who've come from elsewhere. Like, I'm thinking of the lady from the Philippines, and then there's the I believe they're from Hong Kong that moved from Vancouver up there. Is that right?
The Zhus are from Vancouver, and the parents moved from China.
Oh, from China, pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
So, are there a lot of people that come from elsewhere? I mean, elsewhere from outside of Canada that end up there, end up north?
I think it does attract a lot of people for the same reasons that. I would say, you know, remote BC and the Yukon and Alaska attracts anyone. You know, if you go to Europe and you see how crowded it is and how you can't really have any kind of real wilderness or even space, you can see the attraction of being in a remote place where you don't have to. I mean, you need a telescope to see your neighbor, you know?
Mm.
So I think a lot of people, like, for instance, with Eva and Dan Splane, who have Silver Fox Roadhouse, you know, Eva's from the Philippines, but she loves doing these things which are traditional activities in northern and rural Canada, as well as in Alaska, you know, berry picking, mushroom picking, this kind of harvesting, which is really part of our culture. In the north, and you know, it's something that she didn't really wasn't easily accessible in the Philippines.
Yeah, and so Lily, when you're talking to a lot of these folks about the remoteness, do they give you any insight as to what they've learned about themselves? Say,
well, some for instance, Amanda Harris, who runs Yukon Discover Yukon Lodgings. She when she took on the business, she thought she knew, you know, what had going for her, what her strengths were, what her weaknesses were, and then she kept being given these challenges, and then she found out she had more resources and more strengths, and then And then, you know, in 2016, they had a fire there. And luckily, it was a generator fire, so luckily it didn't spread to the rest of the property. But, you know, she really had to dig deep in herself to come over that. And as I think anyone who's experienced a fire, a house fire, a wildfire, it's a really traumatic experience. And just being able to recover from that, she's found greater strength within herself.
Yeah.
There's a number of folks that also are sort of self-taught. Like when we were talking to Buckshot Betty, Lily, help me out, I'm forgetting her name at the moment.
Carmen Hinson.
Yeah, right. Carmen Hinson. She taught herself to weld and how to do plumbing and how to, change tires and, you know, repair pumps. And, you name any sort of physical plant thing, she had to teach herself how to do. And she took over, she had Pine Valley. And that's also sort of a trait. Folks come up from the South, they think they got this handled. And then they realize, well, I don't know anything about generators. And I need to be able to fix that without having to call out a very, very costly repair person from Whitehorse, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that makes me think of the Dieterdings who had Border City Lodge just on the other side of the Alaskan border. And Neil's parents bought it, but they weren't able to deal with any of the repairs that were needed in the property. And then he bought it from his parents, and at a very young age, he bought it. And then he went on to really grow it and fix it up, and he had those qualities that, you know, his parents didn't quite have.
Yeah. What, it also speaks, your book speaks to how we have changed our habits in terms of traveling. Because I guess anywhere we go, and I'm sure there are people traveling this highway as we speak, who the minute they get to some place are looking for the Wi-Fi password or something like that. I guess you do have to turn a lot of that stuff off nowadays, don't you?
It's getting better along the road in terms of cell service in the major centers.
Uh-huh.
But you're right, internet at the lodges is a real blessing and a curse. It allows folks to be connected to the outside, but then there's this expectation that you'll provide this service for free to your guests. And, of course, the cost, we have bandwidth caps up here. That's when you're in a city and you're on the main line, it's fast and easy, but there's still overage charges. And if you're running it off of satellite internet, it's prohibitively expensive. So a number of lodges have decided to remove the internet from their services they offer. Some places will have it, like, just within the cafe or the sitting area in the main building, but not extended to the campsite of, like, cabins. And some folks have it not at all.
A funny story.
Yeah.
Sorry, a funny story is when Mark and I went to Watson Lake Visitor Center on our way down on our book tour.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in there, and we're about to do a presentation, and all these people kept coming into the visitor center, and all they were doing was just coming in to check their email, check their Facebook, download stuff, because they hadn't had internet since Muncho Lake.
Which sounds like a long way away.
Yeah.
It's only 3 hours.
Yeah, it's only 3 hours. It's not that far, but they were hardly even looking at the displays in the visitor center. They're just walking, sitting down in front of their iPads or their tablets, their phones, their computers.
Yeah, and I'm thinking when you're going up there, I mean, there's a lot around to take in. You know, that's natural. Then again, I live in the city, and I've developed a stooped neck because I've been looking at my phone all the time.
Yeah. Well, folks are still doing that in Watson Lake.
Yeah. What are your summer plans? I mean, I understand that you've done a bit of traveling to promote the book, and you're continuing that over the next few weeks. Is that right?
We'll be doing a couple of things. We still have to lay out the next stage's schedule. But, we'll be heading up the highway a little bit here and there, I think, over the next few months.
Lily, what are vacations like for you in the summer? I mean, where did you go places? I mean, one would think living up there, there's a great deal to see as it is.
Well, my summer is, I don't do vacation in the summer. My partner, he's a gold miner, and he works out of town, so on my weekends, I go up and visit him at the gold mine. And I take my vacations in the fall or the spring.
Yeah.
But, you know, I live basically in downtown Whitehorse, but if I walk to the end of the street, which is 100 meters, I'm in the wilderness. So I'm in the wilderness like every day. So I go sea kayaking, hiking, mountain biking. We have a cabin. I go to the cabin, you know, that kind of stuff.
And Mark, you have a child, is that right? How old are they?
I have one son. He's five years old.
Yeah.
And he loves the outdoors. We'll spend a significant part of the summer. I was just out at my property yesterday digging an outhouse. And so he'll be lowered into the hole at some point to help get the deep dirt out.
Yeah.
We'll be there off and on all summer.
And how does he like traveling the highway?
Seth loves it now. When he was younger, he's a very good traveler. But my wife is a very good car entertainer, so she reads voraciously and that sort of thing. So he enjoys being on the road. We're spending the weekend with the bike relay that runs between Haines Junction and Haines, Alaska. So we'll be driving for the whole day tomorrow and part of the day today.
Yeah.
And, he's a great traveler.
Yeah. Lily, when you think about, I said earlier, you know, it seems like a real lifestyle to run a lodge along this stretch of road. Are you hopeful, even though the numbers have declined and look like they're declining, as to this lifestyle, remaining up there?
I think there are, you know, definitely some people who are going to continue running their lodges for a very long time. Some lodges are, the possibility that they are actually running businesses is their location. So, for instance, like Coal River, when we went down there recently, she told us that they weren't as busy as they had been the year before, and she figured that the lodge opposite the Liard Hot Springs Provincial Park was open. And so when we drove by, we saw, oh, yeah, it was open, and so therefore that affects Donna's business at Coal River. If you're strategically located, you can provide fuel where it's needed or meals where it's needed. And I think that you either have to have, like in the case of Silver Fox Roadhouse, like he bought the lodge in the 70s, and he's paid it off. Mm. They don't owe anything on the property, and so they can keep running it as they like. He's got a job he does 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they really just run it because they enjoy it, and they don't really have to worry about anything. And if you're that kind of business, then you're definitely going to be okay. Someone at one of our readings said that maybe the future of lodges lies in providing a recharging facility for electric cars.
Mm.
I mean, that's possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't really know what the future looks like. The ones that are there now have been there a long time, and they're also in very strategic locations. So I guess we will see.
Yeah. Well, you've done it, both of you, Mark and Lily, such a wonderful service in terms of capturing this history, because it's our collective history, obviously. But making some of us who've read the book just aching to want to get up there. So safe travels this summer, Mark, and all the best, Lily. Thanks for your time today, both of you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That was wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Joe.